And I've been with Susie off and on in Florida for God knows how long now, decades. And if I were the DeSanti, I would sleep with one eye open for the rest of my political career, however short that may be. I don't think she's ever going to forgive that.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night, and good luck.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Rick Wilson. Thank you so much for joining us once again. Every campaign cycle produces a spate of books. The histories of it, from either people inside the campaigns or people who covered the campaigns. And every cycle, there's a definitive book. And the definitive book of the 2024 campaign cycle is about to pop out in bookstores and online everywhere. It's called 2024. How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. Josh Dossi, Tyler Pager, and Isaac Arnsdorf have put together, I think, one of the best histories. And look, I am a campaign nerd from childhood, and so I've got a library upstairs of post-campaign books. This is an absolutely tremendous inside-the-room history of this campaign. And gentlemen, I want to thank you for coming on here and talking with us right out of the gate. First and foremost, I want to say this is a terrific book, and I want to start with and go around the circle here. What did you learn about both of these candidates, about Harris and about Trump, that surprised you in the writing of this history? And we'll start with you, Josh.
Well, I think what sort of surprised us in reporting out the book was the sort of shrewd and cynical choices that Trump made to win this election. You know, on abortion, for example, going against what a lot of folks on the right wanted him to do, on early voting, going against his own instincts of falsely saying the election was stolen, you know, to cut ads telling people to early vote that were aired around the country, to the way he interacted with donors, spending hundreds of hours calling and cultivating donors in a way he had not done in the past, and to frankly, you know, at the lack of being laughed at, being a little bit more disciplined than he had been in the past about his messaging at key moments. Not always. He went on sort of a stemwinder tangents and the discursive rants that he's known for. But when it mattered on a number of occasions, he sort of stuck to the message. And I think what we saw here was a campaign that was more structured than his previous efforts and had a better theory of the case and frankly knew how to exploit his opponent better than he had in the past. I'll let Tyler take the Harris part if he wants.
Yeah, Rick, and thank you so much for having us and your kind words about the book. We really appreciate it. And to focus in on Harris, I think one of the things I covered her 2019 presidential campaign, which started with so much enthusiasm and excitement and vaulted her to sort of one of the top candidates in that race. She didn't even make it to the Iowa caucuses. And one of the things that really plagued that campaign was a lack of a message, a lack of a clear identity, a lack of why are you running beyond just Trump is a danger. And as a Democrat, I oppose what he's doing. And I think if you look at this 2024 campaign, that is something that also was a real challenge for her and the campaign. Obviously, a much truncated timeline, less opportunity to develop. But again, it wasn't, you know, one of the big issues, as we write about extensively in the book, is they struggle over how to talk about Donald Trump, how to define him, how to dent his approval ratings. They struggle on the economy. They struggle to respond to the attacks on the transgender ads. And I think part of those struggles center on her inability to really articulate what she was running for, not just running against Donald Trump, but what she really stood for.
Something that always sticks with me about our Harris reporting is how, you know, whatever you think about Harris's weaknesses and how badly her 2019 campaign went and how you think she would have done as a candidate, she really didn't get the chance. I mean, she, in those last 100 days, they just kept running the Biden campaign. Very few of the people in charge ever changed. And so so that really stuck with me that, you know, she couldn't escape Biden's shadow and her inability to distance herself from him. But also the campaign, there just wasn't time to actually make a campaign that made sense for a different candidate. And on the Trump side, you know, I always think about there's a story in the book where You know, his most belligerent advisor, Chris LoSavito, lashes out at Larry Hogan for saying that people should accept the verdict in the New York trial. And then behind the scenes, Trump tells Chris to lay off Larry because we need the vote. And it's that kind of Trump in private where he's capable of being more less impulsive and then he looks in public where he's kind of doing a shtick that I found really interesting.
I think one of the through lines of this book that you guys really dig into better than almost anybody, I think, is how Susie Wiles, who was a bit of a lost soul after she was thrown out of the DeSantis orbit back in the day, late in her career, finally finds the message in the moment to get Trump back into a groove where he's not going to blow himself up. In some ways, it strikes me as a story a lot about Susie and Chris and how they take this journey with Trump, that Chris sort of gets pulled in, I won't say through trickery, but it wasn't an overt deal. But Susie really found herself in this campaign, didn't she?
I view Susie Wiles as one of the most important, if not most important, characters in this campaign. I mean, if you look back to 2021 after, you know, the riots at the Capitol and Trump trying to overturn the election and, you know, taking all the classified documents and not giving them back and the kids in Georgia and the felonies in New York, I mean, Trump was in real trouble. And I think now when you are in this moment, it's easy to forget what it looked like back then. I mean, he was a pariah sure. in a lot of ways, right? And Susie Wiles came to Mar-a-Lago and had several meals with him and sort of helped him reconstruct his future. She brought LoSavito in. She brought Fabrizio right. in. She put together a team. And it wasn't always easy sailing back in those days. I mean, there were a few people who we had around him, you know, Jason Miller and Stephen Chung and a few folks. But most people did not want to be there. I mean, if you look, one of the stories we could reconstruct in the book is about the launch of his campaign. And they can't even get senators to come. They have zero senators.
Right.
They have a few low-level members of Congress, right? They mm-hmm. give no celebrities. They put the guy with the brick suit, you know, the Trump guy, up like almost right. on the front row with the VIPs. They didn't have anything going. I mean, this was a pretty rough time for him. And Susie, mm-hmm. I think, was able to channel him in a way that few people had ever been able to do before. And I just think if you read throughout the book, I mean, one of the things I hope readers take away from it is, you know, what a role she had in sort of this comeback of sorts.
And Rick, you mentioned how she had been cast aside by DeSantis previously, and Trump was there for her when she was Lois. And I think that there was something when people ask, you know, why does Susie do it? There was something very powerful about him being there for her when she needed it. And then her coming in to help him when he was at his lowest.
And I've been with Susie off and on in Florida for God knows how long now, decades. And if I were the DeSanti, I would sleep with one eye open for the rest of my political career, however short that may be. I don't think she's ever going to forgive that. A lot of this story is also, and I think the election came down in a lot of ways, as you said, you know, she had 100 days to put a campaign together. And she only had 100 days because the president's advisors put a shield wall around him, even after the debate, which was a roaring disaster. Let me ask you this question, and I'll whoever wants to take it. The debate showed us that Joe Biden had lost more than a step. And while at the time I didn't feel like it was my job as an ex-Republican to go out and say, hey, you got to get out of the race, my guts fell through the floor when I saw that debate. Talk to us about how the Biden campaign and the Biden circle felt about that debate and how the Trump campaign felt about that debate.
Start with how the Biden people felt about it. They were shocked and appalled, just like many millions of Americans that watched it unfold in real time. You know, we extensively recount debate preparations in this book with a lot of detail about what those prep sessions look like. And the president was not very good in them. He was not feeling well. They canceled a lot of them. They overhauled that the schedule that they had outlined. And Ron Klain, who led debate prep and has led debate prep for many Democrats, was deeply concerned about how prepared he was going to be. All that being said, they did not expect and had never seen Biden perform like that. And so there was complete and utter disbelief inside the hold rooms, inside the campaign HQ, across the board. And so their belief was it was an anomaly because they had never seen anything like that.
And at the Trump campaign, you know, they were like, there's a scene where they're actually like clutching each other and saying, oh my God, it's happening. Like, they, you know, this is what they dreamed of. And actually, they thought that the TV wasn't working because they couldn't hear Biden speaking. And they realized actually the TV was not the problem. But you remember that they even before the debate was over, their spin, their message was the Democrats are stuck with him. He's the nominee. They were already realizing that maybe they had caught the car and they could be in trouble if Biden ended up dropping out.
Well, one added point there, you know, the Trump folks, for all of their public attacks on Biden for losing his faculties, for being out of it, you know, before the debate, they were spinning, you know, Biden's a practice debater, Biden will be good on stage, you know, he can prepare. A lot of their talking points were sort of about, you know, that Biden is going to land more punches in the debate than, you know, he would otherwise. And that's the kind of scenario he'll be ready for. And in fact, he was so bad in the middle of the debate that the Trump people rushed in printers to print out new talking points because they were even surprised at how awful he was, right? They had been telling people for months, this guy's so mentally out of it, but they didn't quite believe it was going to be that bad. It even caught them by surprise. And I just sort of love the visual of like Trump's folks bringing and rushing in new printers to try and get new talking points out because, you know, it even went worse than they hoped it would.
There are a couple inflection points in this campaign. I think the debate was clearly the first truly terrifyingly bad inflection point. After the debate, that shield wall around Biden got even more aggressive and tight. It still held on for a while longer. Talk to us about the process between the end of that debate and the moment he decided at long last it's time.
And I think immediately after that debate, we saw a lot of calls for Biden to drop out publicly from the New York Times editorial board and columnists that Biden had deep respect for. But one of the striking things in the book is how hard it was for people to get to Joe Biden. I mean, one anecdote we have in there is about Senator Chris Coons, the Delaware senator who is very close to Joe Biden, a huge campaign surrogate. And he struggled to get to Joe Biden. And the campaign pollsters who were supposed to have a meeting with Biden after never meeting with him throughout the entire campaign had a meeting schedule. It was then pushed back and canceled. So there's this whole effort across the Democratic Party, the campaign, to get to Joe Biden, to give him some advice, some warnings. I mean, one of the things that's remarkable, Rick, as you look back in the book, is the delay between Biden's debate and him actually doing anything to try to prove that that was an anomaly, right? Like that period, and I was actually the print pool reporter. So I was in the debate hall that night. I flew with him on Air Force One back to New York and then to the Hamptons, all the way till he was dropped off at Camp David, where he meets his family for that weekend. And it was just as if nothing had gone wrong. We have this really revealing scene in the book on Air Force One as Biden is flying from New York to the Hamptons to go to this fundraiser. He's sort of taking the pulse of his aides and they're like, oh, everything's fine. Like, we can just get through this. No big deal. And there's some people sitting there appalled that no one is saying to the president, this is a huge monumental crisis that you need to deal with. So much so that the first time he really has this post-debate reckoning is with this group of high-dollar donors at a small fundraiser in East Hampton at this huge mansion, really nice house, by the way. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it was quite the tour through the ultra wealthy in East Hampton. But it was really just the scene where these donors are like, what is going on? We can't continue on this way. But still, Biden doesn't jump into gear and try to change the narrative or prove to the American people that that was a one-off bad incident.
It struck me that that window of time, I don't know if it would have made the difference with Harris, but it certainly was a lost era for the Democratic Party, that a lost moment. And I think it also hurt candidates down the ballot as well. I spoke to some candidates who were down the ballot who were just absolutely like freaked out because they saw this gap, this long, like that was the only question they were getting, and down to like state party level stuff. Everybody was like, what about Biden? What about Biden? I was getting calls from donors like, how do you get him out? I'm like,
well, and Rick, also one of our favorite scenes in the book is the meeting that Biden's top campaign aides have with Democratic senators. And they just go line by line saying just sort of remarkable things. And, you know, one of the senators says, like, we can't continue to defend him. It's going to hurt our credibility. Joe Manchin says it's like that time you need to take the car keys away from grandpa. And they're exhorting Biden's top aides to relay this to Biden because they themselves have no access to him.
So the toughest job in that moment, and I weirdly know a lot of her friends, a lot of my California people or her people and blah, blah, blah. What is going through her mind starting from the debate? I know she had to walk an incredible tightrope. So let's talk about that a little bit and your coverage of that.
Yeah, I think it's a really challenging situation for Kamala Harris. And what she told her aides in the aftermath of this is, I don't want any contingency planning. I don't want to discuss this. She felt it was her responsibility to be Joe Biden's staunchest defender and support him publicly. What's interesting is behind the scenes, there is some machinations going on with her family and aides planning for the what if. They felt it would be irresponsible to at least put in some thinking about what would happen if Biden were to drop out. And there's this remarkable moment when the moment Joe Biden does actually drop out, her brother-in-law and a few of her closest aides are meeting privately away from her to think through what they should do if Biden drops out and how she would try to take over the campaign and run the race. And so she's really caught in between publicly and privately saying, you know, I can't do anything but support Joe Biden, while her family and aides are plotting how she would build a presidential campaign and try to win an election in just over 100 days.
Let's jump over to the other side of the fence here for a second. And I want to come back to Harris in a minute. But we go into the conventions. And at this point, we've sort of had this almost clownish eating the dogs, eating the cats vibe happening.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
We've had Vance ascending to the VP thing. I want to talk a little bit about Trump's VP sweepstakes and how that worked out, because there were a lot of people with different interests and layers in that fight. Talk to us about how Vance became the guy, even though he had been a stern critic of Trump. You know, I consider J.D. Vance one of our, you know, allies in the 2016 fight in the Never Trump world. Talk to us about how he ascended from into that job.
One of the key things that he did is, as soon as he won his Senate race, he reached out to Trump's team and let them know that he would support Trump. And Trump was really keeping track of who was endorsing him and when and how enthusiastically. And again, like we were saying earlier, you know, that was not an obvious thing to do. You know, J.D. Vance was not the most obvious person to be doing that for the reasons you mentioned. And also at that time, you know, there were a lot of other senators who were keeping their powder dry and wanted to see how things were going to shake out. So that meant a lot to Trump. And it gave him, you know, he just came out and owned it. You know, he said he blamed the media for giving him the wrong idea about Trump and said that he had changed his tune and he was going to be loyal now. And they got along well, particularly J.D. with Trump's son, Don Jr. He got along with Chris. They bonded over Marine stuff. Susie really came to like how he was a team player. He would deliver the talking points, whether it was on Meet the Press or a far right podcast. Vance's team didn't participate in any of the side swiping and backstabbing that some of the other contenders were doing. And so that really endeared him to the whole team.
I still find him to be a fascinating choice, because knowing the guy enough to know you know, he's a bit of a bureaucratic player at the end of the day. And I think I think he must be having some days where he has the same thing Harris went through. Like, what if it all goes off the rails? What happens if I have to step up to this thing? We'll be right back. And now back to the show. I think the key inflection points, we get to the conventions. I had heard from a Trump person at one point that they watched her in the convention, were like, well, that was a pretty good week for her, but that they weren't petrified by her. And they weren't thrilled by him, except that it was coming off of Butler. So I want to go through your coverage, because I think that is the key inflection point that locked down the MAGA base then and forever when the assassination attempt was made on him. Walk us through your coverage of that story, because I think it is the moment that defined the rest of the campaign in a lot of ways.
Well, I think on Butler, I mean, Trump said himself to us in an interview for the book, you know, I think it probably did help me win a little bit. It probably helped my chances, right? I mean, I think after Butler, he came to the convention in Milwaukee and, you know, wanted to rewrite his speech entirely. You know, he made that triumphant thing into the arena with the ear patch on. And, you know, what was really interesting, though, in those moments is the campaign saw it as a way to sort of crystallize, you know, him as a frontrunner, dominant candidate. The speech was supposed to be this powerful, poignant moment where he comes out on the stage and talks about what happened. And, you know, I was up in the boxes that night with the top RNC and Trump folks. And, you know, at the beginning of a speech, everyone was just enraptured by sort of him coming out and telling the story. And then he just droned on and on and on and on to the point that, like, people sort of stopped paying attention and people were, like, ready to go home. And the speech did not go as well as they hoped. And it really entered into that weekend, was when Trump gets shot on a Saturday. And then the next Sunday, they switch of candidates, right? It's a week period there. And I'd say that enters into the sort of darkest time for Trump's candidacy, as we chronicle in the book. He's quite angry that Kamala Harris is now the nominee. He's sort of in a funk. He's, you know, really lashing out at people, lashing out at donors, lashing out at his aides. And folks on the campaign are really furtively trying to figure out sort of how to get his groove back. And so what eventually probably did, in his mind at least, become a political asset to him, the horrible, you know, assassination attempt, as he said, you know, probably end up helping my candidacy. In those moments after those first few weeks, it felt very tenuous.
I think that the assassination attempt had less to do with the base that was already so behind him and more to do with voters who were, you know, either soft Trump supporters or, but, you know, had enough of this. You know, it was like they really identified with that idea of, like, what else is going to happen to this guy? And they thought he looked cool and they thought he looked strong, and that they went from kind of being uncommitted to being to being more firm in their support or more open about their support. And, you know, I think there were a lot of regular voters like that, but the most important person like that was Elon Musk, who, right, you have to remember was, you know, had very mixed feelings about,
sure,
Trump. That's why he started a super PAC of his own. Mm-hmm. He didn't trust Trump people to run the campaign with his money.
Right.
And it wasn't until Butler that he became an enthusiastic Trump supporter.
He did have a real shaping effect in this campaign at the end of the day. I can see why, if you're going to drop $250 million, you want your own sort of fiduciary handle on it, given the people that have been around Trump historically.
Elon wanted to help Trump, but he didn't want to give directly. And he was trying to convince other billionaires, other sort of titans of the universe, to give indirectly too, to help too, right? And he was afraid the money would go to Trump's legal challenges. He, you know, was not fully there, but he would call Ronna McDaniel and he would call Trump's aides and go on these long tangents about illegal immigration and how, you know, it was going to ruin the Republican Party forever. And he sort of got into a lot of these voting conspiracies, Elon did, right? And he eventually became, like, full-throated on board. But he started from a place of let's kind of give some money through some dark groups, through some behind the scenes efforts to help Trump without being publicly linked to it. And then by the end, obviously that was a different story.
Yeah, the whole like hire Jeff Rowe idea is always weirdly appealing to billionaires before they realize that nobody ever hires Jeff Rowe twice. Talk to me a little bit about Harris and the Democratic convention, because as a former Republican, it was my first Democratic convention. I've been going to a Republican convention since 1972, because I'm old. But it was it struck me that she delivered, I think, very well her keynote speech. I think I heard from a couple of Republicans who were a little like, oh shit, they got American flags now. The look and feel of it was a little different than I think they expected. You know, they wanted their, like, where's the Antifa contingent on the floor and all that shit. They were a little surprised. But talk to me about how Harris's team felt about the convention, because that was, a moment where they thought they might have turned the corner a little bit.
This is part of that summer where they feel the vibes are all on their side. We had, you know, from the Democratic perspective, there was this year and, you know, almost a half long slog when Joe Biden was the nominee, and there just wasn't this sort of excitement. He wasn't doing rallies. He wasn't pulling in crowds. And that's because for, you know, this entire period, the polling showed the majority of Democratic voters did not want him to be the nominee. So I think that's an important sort of baseline to remember. And so then when Harris takes over, there's just this burst of enthusiasm and excitement about a Democratic nominee that the party had not felt for years. And so I think the convention, they felt, was a good opportunity to put that on display. I think in retrospect, there are some people who have criticisms, that like any post-election review, about the sort of messaging coming from that convention. And a lot of what Kamala Harris was running on was this campaign of joy, bringing joy back into politics. Her and Tim Walz really leaned into that. And what voters were saying was that we're unhappy. We're not feeling good about the economy. We're not feeling good about our situation. Inflation was still persistent. Global insecurity, you know, new technology. There's just this sort of sense of dislocation and isolation that a lot of Americans were feeling. And there's some concern that Democrats didn't really speak to that or propose what they would do. And I think another challenge that was unique about that convention was that the Democrats had to both balance introducing Kamala Harris to the nation and also drawing a contrast with Trump. And so in that, there were some who said, well, right, we didn't really put forward what our message was. We were introducing Kamala Harris from a biographical standpoint because a lot of voters kept saying they didn't feel like they knew her, part of this truncated timeline, and also trying to run against Trump. And they also had to reinvent the entire convention under a compressed timeline because they had a new nominee.
I think one of the things that you guys identified in the book was the failure, not only of the Biden campaign, but also the Harris campaign, to bifurcate the problem of a lot of top-level economic statistics that were booming and looked great, but a lot of public skepticism and anger and frustration with inflation that Trump very, I think, keenly tapped into. Do you think did they ever try to find a way to stick the landing on that? Because it always felt like they missed that one connective piece of, like, being empathetic. Were they afraid of, like, seeming to criticize Biden, or what was the problem there?
That's exactly right, Rick. One they were struggling with was they felt that if they did not tout their own economic record, nobody would. And so they were proud of the legislation they passed. They were proud of the economic indicators that showed success, but they struggled to reckon with the fact that Americans weren't feeling that level of success. And one of the things we have in the book is about the pollsters encouraging Biden and his team to take a more empathetic message when it comes to the economy, to understand that despite the GDP growing or unemployment dropping, that Americans were feeling pain across the board, pain at the pump, pain at the grocery store. And Trump really exploited that vulnerability. He focused in on the prices. Josh and Isaac can talk about this press conference where, you know, he brings out all of these groceries to talk about how expensive items were. But he was able to really tap into these concerns that Americans had about the cost of goods. And the Biden people really struggled with that because they wanted to promote their record And sometimes that overshadowed the pain that Americans were feeling, and they just weren't able to really, as you say, land the plane there.
There's a great moment in Harris's debate prep where they're going through, you know, like, what are her key points going to be on every issue? And they get to the economy and they keep going, oh, well, that's a tough one. Let's come back to it. And they never come up with anything. I mean, they recognized that they needed to have a winning message on the economy, and they just never formulated one. And part of it was the defensiveness that, you know, these were the people who brought you Biden's economic policies, who were not going to admit any fault.
One of the through lines of a book, I thought, in the last couple months, was on the Trump side. You know, Trump would be antsy or anxious about a news cycle or about a poll or whatever sort of had animated him in that moment, and would want to move to immigration or to some topic of the day or to whatever the du jour issue was. And Tony Fabrizio, his pollster, would repeatedly say to them, if we keep this on the economy, we're going to win. We're going to win. And he would show them numbers every day, every week on the economy, every week on the economy. And it was a place that they were, you know, up double digits on the Harris Biden administration. There were other issues where they were closer to even. On some issues like trust and honesty, they were trailing. But on the economy, they were always ahead in the race. And, you know, Fabrizio and really Susie Wiles near the end were just trying to keep them focused on making an economic election. And Trump would, what they would sort of do with him is this famous press conference that we write about in the book at Bedminster, where he has all this food out, you know, and Isaac, I think you were there maybe, right? He has all his food sitting out, groceries spoiling in the sun, and he's back in the event, and they give him his binder of economic stuff that they want him to read. He's like, this is boring. I don't want to read this, right? And they have to beg him. They're like, you can take questions and you can do whatever you want. After, please just read this binder. Read this binder. We want you to read this binder. And that's frankly what they would do with him regularly. They would give him, you know, an economic speech to read, to talk about inflation, to talk about, you know, whatever the metrics were that they wanted to highlight. And Trump wouldn't want to. And then, you know, they can convince him to sometimes.
We'll be right back. And now, back to the show. And one last issue on the campaign that I think I saw it sort of up close. We were hearing out of Harris, you know, the old friend of the friend network, like, this trans issue is eating us alive. We're losing all these male voters. Maybe Lincoln Project, maybe somebody else, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like there's an old rule that you know, if you watch where Republicans spend money, that's what works for them. And they were spending money on that in some of these like sports broadcasting, male-oriented audiences, things like that. Talk to us a little bit about how Trump's world saw that issue and how Harris's world saw that issue and the disconnect on how that was, on how Harris didn't understand how badly that was undermining them with certain demos.
The Trump campaign went back and looked at the data from 2020, and the insight that they made was, you know, that the conventional wisdom was that Trump lost 2020 because he lost ground with women. You know, that was kind of, mm-hmm. You thought about the stereotype of the suburban soccer mom. And actually, sure. They saw that it was his performance with men that suffered and that made the difference. You know, sort of the way they described it was, it wasn't the woman who voted for Romney in 2012 and then Clinton in 2016 who they needed to worry about. It was her husband who voted for Trump in 2016 and Biden in 2020. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other way they would say it is like the gender gap goes both ways. You know, if they can run up the sure. score with men, then they can afford to not do as well with women. And in some ways they had to do that because Trump had driven away so many Republicans like yourself who were mm-hmm. you know, the reliable voters. They had to go after some higher hanging fruit, some people who didn't as frequently vote, but would vote Republican if they did. And so that was a huge change in this election. Usually the less likely voters skewed Democrat, and that switched for the first time.
Trump folks on the you know, sort of famous trans ad. I mean, when they realized what she had said back in 2019 on, you know, surgeries for inmates and for immigrants back in part of that ACLU survey, they knew it would be a potential hit, right? I mean, they shopped it around to media outlets. They were trying to get it out there. But when they did the ad, they could not believe how well it tested. And then Charlemagne the God goes out and, you know, praises the ad or says, not praises the ad, but says, you know, can you believe this? And sort of seems critical of Harris's position on this. And then they make that into another ad, right? And then it sort of becomes this life of its own thing. And I think at the time they, you know, in retrospect, everyone says, oh, that was a key moment of the election, you know, that ad X, Y, Z. But at the time, I think even Trump's people were surprised at how well it was resonating in that moment.
From the Harris perspective, I think, Rick, you would have some interesting insight into this as someone who's worked on all these campaigns. But they tested a lot of different responses to how she should respond. So was it taking it head on? Was it trying to explain that Trump had the same policy for his Department of Justice when he was in office? And what they said they found is that the best response, which is just talk about other issues, that issue was potent, but economic issues mattered more, for example. So what they did was they just pivoted away. But the problem was, and strategists and Harris officials now say, is she never had any response. So maybe in sort of the silos of ad testing, the ad that theoretically tests the best is a different, you know, topic. But at the end of the day, people were seeing that ad over and over and again, and nothing from Kamala Harris. So there wasn't that response, the countering to that ad that proved to be really devastating. And so there's a lot of regret within the Democratic Party about the lack of any sort of response.
We did one that generated basically said, it touched that it was his policy at first, but then it basically said, he's lying to you because he wants to screw you. It's he, him, not they, them. And it tested very well. I had one senior Democratic money person say, well, we tested it and we're afraid of blowback from our own allies on it. So we're not going to do it. I was like, okay. It really struck me as a big miss. Look, I want to say I've kept you guys a little longer than the time I promised, but folks, I want to say this. 2024 is a magisterial history of this election. It is a enlightening read. I really recommend this book. It's How Trump Retook the White House and the Democrats Lost America. Because in campaigns, folks, one person wins and one person loses, and they both do things that lead to that point. And it's a really great inside look at this. Josh, Tyler, Isaac, I want to thank you guys for coming on today. Folks, get this book. It's tremendous. So with that, gentlemen, thank you so much, and we'll see you again soon, I hope.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.